This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Today, new evidence that the pace of job growth is picking up. The government's employment report for December showed 200,000 jobs added to payrolls. The unemployment rate continued its downward trend, falling to 8.5%. And while that may be welcome news, as NPR's John Idzdi explains, the December report could be overstating job growth.
Prior to the release of today's report, economists surveyed by news organizations expected an increase of only about 150,000 jobs. So the news of 200,000 new jobs was a pleasant surprise. Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics says it's a signal of an uptick in economic growth.
And we're going into 2012 with some momentum. So it feels really good to get some solid job numbers.
But some economists pointed to a big jump in the number of couriers and messengers in the December report, an increase of 42,000 in a job category that normally adds or subtracts no more than 1,000 jobs a month. Their view is that the 42,000 increase represents a seasonal boom in businesses like UPS and FedEx delivering holiday packages from internet retailers. Nariman Baravish and his colleagues at IHS Global Insight believe it's likely December's big increase in those jobs will be followed by an offsetting decrease in January. That's what happened last year in this sector. Baravis says despite the headline number in the December report, the trend in job growth really hasn't moved up to the 200,000 a month level.
Our view right now is that the underlying number is around 150,000, and that's what we can probably expect in the coming months.
However, an analyst at the Labor Department says its seasonal adjustments, which are updated regularly, should have smoothed out any seasonal hiring distortion. Mark Zandi of Moody's says he was actually more surprised by the drop in the unemployment rate to 8.5% than the bigger-than-expected jobs increase. Economists had thought that after a big decline in November, the unemployment rate might actually tick up again in December.
Very surprising. It's in part due to better job growth.
But while that may be true, there are other factors that have pushed the unemployment rate down rapidly over the past 4 months. Most importantly, a decline in the size of the labor force. That's been caused partly by discouraged workers who've given up looking for jobs. But Zandi says it's also due to demographic changes, a smaller stream of immigrants coming into the U.S. looking for work, and an aging population retiring.
Most recently, in the last few months, in last year, most of the decline in labor force participation is among females, and it's among college-educated white females.
Zandi says at the same time, the number of men in the workforce is growing.
Lots of different things going on here. I don't think there is a solid answer. At least I don't have one, not yet.
At an appearance today in Washington, President Obama wasn't asking why. He was just touting the job growth numbers over the past year.
More private sector jobs were created in 2011 than any year since 2005. And there are a lot of people that are still...
And now many economists are suggesting the unemployment rate could be at 8% by Election Day. Nariman Baravish says that still may not be enough to win a second term for Mr. Obama.
I would say right now the president has something of an uphill battle on the economy, even if we see further progress on the unemployment rate.
Baravish bases his view on a model that measures the effect of unemployment rates on elections historically. It suggests unemployment would have to go well below 8% to not be a drag on the president's chances for a second term. John Idzdi, NPR News, Washington.
Our last word in business is roar of disapproval. According to the traditional Chinese calendar, the year of the rabbit gives way to the year of the dragon later this month. This week, the Chinese government started selling new stamps to commemorate the year of the dragon. After a year of mailing off postage with cute bunny pictures, some Chinese got a shock when they saw the new stamps. "I was almost scared to death," one blogger wrote, after seeing a stamp with a dragon staring at her. Another called it too ferocious. The stamp's designer said he based his graphic on a motif from the 19th century when the Qing dynasty ruled. He said it's a symbol of China's confidence. Postal officials have no plans to change it. And that's the business news.
From NPR News, it's Morning Edition, directed by Van Williamson and Travis Larchuk. The production staff includes Jess Gittner, Asma Khalid, Kevin Leahy, Lauren McGaughey, Steve Monroe, Vince Pearson, Leah Scarpelli, Selena Simmons-Duffin, Lindsay Totti, and Ashley Westerman, with Ben Bergman and Melissa Yeager-Miller at NPR West.
Our executive producer is Madalika Sicca. The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Jonathan Safran Foer's 2006 novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, explored the horror of 9/11 via multiple narrators, photos, drawings, and even mathematical equations. It's now a film, directed by Stephen Daldry, who made The Hours. It stars Tom Hanks, Sandra Bullock, and newcomer Thomas Horn. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Some critics are indignant over Stephen Daldry's film of Jonathan Safran Foer's book Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. They say the appropriation of 9/11 for such a sentimental work is exploitation. It is a knotty issue. I think Foer wasn't writing about 9/11 so much as using it to explore themes he introduced in his Eastern Europe set debut, Everything is Illuminated. That book had an American trying to come to terms with the legacy of his Jewish forefathers, to counter the elusiveness of memory. And Extremely Loud also has a son hunting for clues. 11-year-old Oscar Schell struggles to find meaning after his dad dies in the World Trade Center. In his lifetime, the father devised puzzles and scavenger hunts to force his fearful son into the world, and Oscar's convinced there's a message at the finish line of his dad's final challenge. Cryptic communication between other fathers and sons show up throughout the book, along with accounts of other attacks, like the bombings of Dresden and Hiroshima. Foer also prints blurry photos of a figure in mid-leap from the World Trade Center. They're items in young Oscar's 9/11 scrapbook. In the film of Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, screenwriter Eric Roth eliminates other characters' perspectives, along with some of the boy's more cutesy tics, and finds a middle ground between jumpy postmodernism and formula uplift. The movie works you over. The first thing on screen is a body, you can't see whose, falling in slow motion through the air, and it made me want to flee. It was too much horror, too fast. The other wrenching device is a series of 6 answering machine messages left by the father, played by Tom Hanks, after the planes hit, his calm assurances increasingly less convincing. For reasons only later apparent, young Oscar, played by Thomas Horn, replaced that machine with an identical model and lied to his mother, played by Sandra Bullock, about calls that came in before she got home. It's the last message he can't bear to share, and it's withheld from us, too, a kind of dramatic striptease until the end. And yes, it's devastating. Thomas Horn was discovered on Kids Week on Jeopardy, and he's not really an actor, more of an intelligent reciter. Fortunately, Oscar is supposed to be a kid with no social graces. When he finds a key in a vase in his dad's closet, in an envelope with the word black, he decides to visit every black in the phone book, all 5 boroughs, starting with the black played by Viola Davis, upset because her husband is moving out.
Who's that?
My husband. You must think this is very odd.
Oh, I think a lot of things are odd. People tell me I'm very odd all the time. I got tested once to see if I had Asperger's disease. Dad said it's for people who are smarter than everybody else but can't run straight. Tests weren't definitive. Are you sure you didn't know him, Thomas Schell? He was in the building in 9/11. I'm trying to find a lock for this key that was in the envelope that once belonged to my father.
Sorry, I don't know anything about the key or your father.
The parade of photogenic, multiracial blacks does get tedious, but the cinematography by Chris Menges gives every neighborhood its own distinctive color and character. And the boy is accompanied in later visits by a mute elderly man known as the Renter, a guest in the apartment of Oscar's German grandmother, and played by Max von Sydow. The inception of his muteness is chronicled in the book, but not the film, and it could have seemed precious if von Sydow, now 82, didn't have such gravity. He's a tragic figure, yet there's a bit of Stan Laurel in his weary shrugs. He makes this man an irreducible mixture of father and child. The other actors, Hanks and Bullock and Viola Davis and Jeffrey Wright, aren't as lucky. They have dialogue. But they're suitably somber, like guests at an important funeral. The problem with Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close is that once the filmmakers strip away the novel's postmodern pastiche and tack on an inspirational Hollywood ending, what's left, this story of a boy's search for a lost father, doesn't fully mesh with 9/11 and doesn't fully earn the right to use such terrible images from our recent past. Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close is extremely powerful and incredibly manipulative. When you dry your tears, you might feel, as I did, angry.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
The Spy Who Jumped Off the Screen is a new novel by Thomas Kaplan, his third work of fiction. As the title suggests, Mr. Kaplan attempts to flip conventions. His hero is a movie star who's called Ty Hunter. You have to be a certain age to get that joke, but movies are Ty Hunter's second career. His first in real life was top secret Delta Force Navy SEAL sorts of adventures. In this book, he's called back to that kind of action by no less a person than the Commander-in-Chief. Thomas Kaplan joins us now. Welcome, Mr. Kaplan.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Now, I understand that you are also personally acquainted with the Commander-in-Chief.
That is true. Because of the luck of the alphabet, I was a student at Georgetown University when we arrived as heady freshmen in 1964. Because of the alphabet, I was assigned room next to Bill Clinton, and we've remained friends ever since and later became roommates.
The former president wrote an introduction for your book.
I was going to say he actually helped to edit an earlier draft because I knew he's a great fan of thrillers and sort of reads them one after another and knows an awful lot about them. And when I'd done this, which was my first thriller, I asked him to read it and he made some wonderful comments.
Well, one of the scenes is where the movie star who used to lead a thrilling life is reactivated by the president. Maybe you could read just a tiny portion of that scene for us.
Right. This is a conversation which the president, Garland White, Ty Hunter, whom we've talked about, and a man called George Kenneth, who is the president's national security advisor.
And this takes place
at
in
Camp
one
David,
of the lodges at Camp David?
In Aspen Lodge, to which Ty has been summoned. Aspen Lodge is the cabin which is the president's house,
okay,
where he and his family live.
Mm-hmm.
You're the man on the ground, Ty, the person we all agree we've been lacking. You're not what we call an invisible exactly. Rather, you're invisible, precisely because you're so damned visible. You've a reason to be anywhere, everywhere. Ty could no longer contain his laughter. What's so funny? George Kenneth asked. Ty inhaled a deep breath. In my line of work, you get used to being pitched, he said, but not by the President of the United States.
Now, to ridiculously simplify your plot, you've written about loose nukes and people who are trying to negotiate a sale of supposedly decommissioned nuclear weapons to the highest bidder.
That's correct.
So did you get any assistance on what might be real or not about such a plot from your very high-level editor?
It's funny because when I showed President Clinton the early draft, the first thing he said to me was, who told you all this about nuclear weapons? I said, no one really. I just, read all of the available books and chatted to people, but obviously I have no access to such things. And he said, well, it's completely right, and including, interestingly, which satisfied me in a way, the motivations of the people who might be trying to do this and the rationalizations they have for their own behavior.
You're talking about the villains, especially
yes.
The arch bad guy whose name is Philip Frost.
Yeah.
You spend a lot of time with him in the book. Did he interest you more than the good guy?
No. I think there's much more about the good guy. But each stands in relief to the other. I mean, they're both roughly the same age. They both have promising careers. And one has chosen to sort of do the right thing and another person has chosen really to be only interested in gain or perhaps power.
To make a huge amount of money doing one awful thing and then vanish. Isn't that his plan?
Well, I think that's one of his plans. I think the interesting thing is in the psychology of somebody like this. He is looking for ways to tell himself that it's not a bad thing that he's doing. Very few people act, in my experience, out of evil motives. At least they may do evil things, but they try to tell themselves that what they're doing is the right thing. And that's what I've tried to give that character, a sense of being very acute at fooling themselves.
So are you getting any interest from the movies? I mean, any chance that the spy might jump back on the screen?
A lot of people have expressed some interest, and my agent is in charge of this, not me. Yeah, I'd love to see it happen, but I'd like to see it happen in the right way.
One problem that I see, of course, is that you'd have an actor playing an actor who's playing a spy. I mean, that's a complicated thing to be doing.
You think so? An actor can play anything. I mean, there have been other actors who, at various times in their careers, were engaged in espionage of one sort. Well-known, Leslie Howard was Gone with the Wind, everyone remembers, and Sterling Hayden. There have been a lot who, at one time or another, have done this. So I think I have a certain vision of Ty in my mind. I suspect readers will have a slightly varied impression. But I think I can think of a lot of people who could do it.
You're casting it already, huh?
Yeah.
So do you see a potential series here? Do you think you'll return to this character?
I'm sure I will, yeah. In fact, I'm almost through the sequel to the book. So I very much like the character. I mean, there may be a bit of fantasy involved because I'm not either a movie star nor a covert operative. But it's fun to sit down every day and write about, not yourself, but write about your character as though you were putting yourself in the mind of the world's number one film star who, you know, has to fight off every beautiful woman and is staggeringly lucky in his work. I had an editor I was working with at Viking who's just terrific, and I were discussing one section of the book, and she suggested that I change one line of dialogue. And I said, well, I think he'd say that. She said, I don't think he would. We went back and forth. And I said, well, I'd say it. And she said, but you're not Ty Hunter. And I said, Allison, don't ever say that to me again. But it is fun. I have to say, I'm enjoying it enormously.
Tom Kaplan, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you very much for having me, Linda.
Thomas Kaplan's new book is called The Spy Who Jumped Off the Screen. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Stephen Skip.
Mitt Romney today jumped on those jobs numbers. Good news, of course, he said, but no cause for celebration, with the unemployment rate above 8% for 35 consecutive months. We'll start our weekly conversation with columnists E.J. Dionne and David Brooks talking about the latest economic news. David Brooks, back from Iowa, here in the studio with me. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
And E.J. up in New Hampshire. Welcome to you, E.J.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And first question to both of you. Mitt Romney is saying that President Obama's policies have slowed the recovery and created misery for millions of Americans who are out of work. If the downward trend continues, if the unemployment rate, David, continues to drop, does that Republican argument lose its potency?
It loses some of its potency. Clearly, if we have a year of declining unemployment rates or good jobs numbers like today, obviously the sense of crisis goes away. I don't think it really erases it, though. The problems with the economy are not so much cyclical now. They're structural. They have to do with wage stagnation, inequality, a sense the country's in long-term decline. I don't think we're going to be in a period of 400,000 or 400 jobs a month growth where people will feel, oh, yeah, it's morning in America. We're not going to see that. So it's still going to be fundamentally jobs, economy, election.
EJ?
Well, it's hard ever to say with confidence, this economic mess is over. But these numbers actually are good news for Obama for a particular reason. The political scientists tell us that voters tend to form their opinions of the economy early in the election year. If they feel badly early, it's very hard to shake them out of that, out of their view. And that hurt President George H.W. Bush in 1992, who was presiding over a much better economy, it turned out, than the voters thought. So starting out strong is certainly helpful, if not decisive, for President Obama. But he needs more months like this. And I think the Republicans will still keep saying what they're saying, because unemployment is still going to be higher than it, way higher than it usually is.
I want to ask you both about a new CNN Time Magazine poll of likely voters in South Carolina, which votes after New Hampshire. The Newt Gingrich lead that we saw a month ago, 43% there, now down to 18%. And Mitt Romney has risen sharply up to 37%. Rick Santorum as well, but Mitt Romney out ahead. If those numbers hold, if Mitt Romney can pull out a win, not just in New Hampshire, but also in socially conservative South Carolina, is the primary fight effectively over there, David?
Yeah, it would move from 85% likely Romney to 95% Romney, and it would sign that he can get above 25%. South Carolina has a lot of social conservatives, has a lot of establishment mainstream conservatives, too. Though I would say what we're going to see over the next couple of weeks, and especially in South Carolina, is an explosion of ill temper. Especially in the debates starting this weekend, South Carolina traditionally has been the nastiest of the primaries. Gingrich is like this unexploded missile that seems to be going off in all directions at once. The Gingrich we've seen so far is going to be like Kelly Ripa compared to the next couple of weeks. So I think we're in for quite a volatile period. It's, or at least a nasty period. It might be like, you know, I assume Romney will still get it, but this will be volatile.
I'm trying to imagine that Newt Gingrich Kelly Ripa mashup. EJ, you're in New Hampshire. Are you sensing this explosion of ill temper that David Brooks is talking about there?
Well, I'm looking forward to its possibility, and we're going to see that. I think we might see it in the debates this weekend. Here's what I'm struck by. I'm struck by the fact that Rick Santorum has an enormous opportunity up here, which he has not fully seized yet. I went to a Santorum event last night in Windham, New Hampshire. And what struck me is that he was running to be an excellent teacher at a Jesuit high school rather than running for president. He gave these long, sometimes Socratic answers. They were actually very interesting, and in some cases, I gave him credit for not pandering to his audience. But he had a real opportunity here, and he still got a little opening to do it. There was some energy coming in. And you don't feel that he's built on that energy. Having said that, I think these numbers in South Carolina suggest, even though I agree with David, it's hard to see any of these other candidates stopping Romney right now. Santorum's now second. Perry is doing very badly. So the fracturing of the non-Romney vote may end by default. And that's got to give Santorum an opportunity, especially if Gingrich ever comes to his support and still does the thing that David suggests he's going to do.
Finally, I want to ask you both about the president's decision this week to do an end run around Republican opposition in Congress. He made recess appointments to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, also appointed three members to the National Labor Relations Board, and there are lots of questions about whether the Senate actually was in recess when he did this, whether these appointments are constitutional. Republicans are outraged. EJ, what are your thoughts?
Well, I say thank God he did this. I mean, what the Republicans have done on Richard Cordray is really irresponsible and I think unprecedented. They are not against him as the head of the Financial Consumer Protection Agency. They want to change a law that's already passed. Well, you don't do that by blocking a presidential appointee. You do that by trying to change the law. And yes, we're going to have these fights about the whether this was will work or not legally. I suspect it will. But the president really made a point of how awful the whole confirmation process has become and how much it's been abused by the Republican minority in the Senate.
David, though, haven't lots of presidents made recess appointments before? Why is this any different?
Well, usually the Senate was actually in recess when they made the recess appointments. You know, to me, this is an example of sort of the perfect hypocrisy. Barack Obama was outraged by recess appointments when President Bush was in office. Now that he's the president, he thinks obstructionism is bad. I'm more on the side of the president in general. I think they should get to appoint the people they want. But I am really struck by the presidential strategy of picking fights with Congress. Out in the country, people are really concerned about big issues, national decline. To get in one little intra-Washington fight after another strikes me as out of scope with what the country wants right now.
Okay. David Brooks of The New York Times here in Washington. E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post up in Manchester, New Hampshire. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have a story about employment today from StoryCorps, which we hear every Friday morning. Family and friends are recording conversations for this project, and today we hear of a chance encounter that changed the lives of two men. In 2005, Marine Richard Bennett returned home from his second deployment in Iraq. He'd been injured. A few years later, Craig Williams was running a successful business and was looking to expand.
I had developed a pretty solid construction company, and I wanted a partner. As an African-American businessman, I wanted a young African-American soldier coming home. It seemed like a great opportunity to provide an opportunity. And I was in a restaurant that I don't normally frequent and picked up a newspaper that I don't normally read. Opened it up, and staring up at me from the page was you. I read the article, and the thing that struck me the most was that here was a young man who had been injured serving our country. And the main thing he was interested in was a risky surgery that would allow him to go back and join his unit. So it was very clear that I had found the man that I was looking for.
I was at home one afternoon, got a call on my cell, calling on behalf of Mr. Williams. He saw your article in the paper, and he would like to meet you. My first question was, do you have the right guy?
I was just very impressed with you. Tremendous courage, tremendous loyalty. Those are all critical characteristics for a partner of any kind. Those are the things you hope for.
I'm humbled that you put that amount of faith in me. You took the ultimate leap of faith here.
I didn't think I was taking too big of a risk, honestly. This is not a charity situation.
Thank you. I'm not sure how much I've ever expressed this, but you inspired a change in my life I never foresaw. I always aspired to be leading people, but you were keen helping me get there.
I just appreciate your friendship and the trust that you've given me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Craig Williams with his business partner Richard Bennett at StoryCorps in Norristown, Pennsylvania. Their conversation will be archived with all the others at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, and you can get the project's podcast at npr.org.